Yesterday, in the afternoon, we considered the yamas, the different moralities, virtues, as taught by Atharvan to Shandilya. And we attempted to meditate upon any particular quality we choose. Now, these qualities are first known to us, cognized by us, by virtue of the particular name of the quality, by the word. Now, the word for us is an intellectual concept. Let us try to explore what is implied in this. What is it that actually happens by which the concept comes into existence? We used words like harmlessness, truthfulness, continence, and so on. And these, as they stand, are but concepts. Wherein is their reality? They are, if I may say so, substantial reality. That's a strange phrase to use in connection with abstract concepts. How does any sort of knowledge begin? When we are born, or rather after we are born, stimuli from outside reach our sense organs, and they make an impress upon the brain. These are percepts, as we call them, the first impressions. But those impressions are not organized. These first cognitions have not come to the stage of being recognized immediately they appear. It is only through the accumulation of the percepts when the stimuli reaches and affect our brain that we begin to recognize the percept. For example, the mother is the closest to the infant most of the time. So the presence of the mother, the sight of her, the sound of her, the smell of her, and so forth, all those impressions accumulate. They are repeated, and so in a short time there is proper cognition of the percept as such. Then a name gets attached to the percept. the sound of the word begins to be associated with the percept as a whole. And this is the emergence of the concept. And this also means the emergence of proper differentiation between this, that, and the other person or thing. But once the concept emerges, it tends to suppress the percept insofar as the full experiencing of the percept is concerned. This is something we should bear very carefully in mind. Let us consider the sense of sight. When the percept begins in its earlier stages, one is aware of shape and color. But this is external to us. We are seeing something outside us. Now, with the accumulation of the percepts, the repetition of the same experience over and over again, and the formation of the concept in association with that which one sees, can it be said that I know what I am seeing? Is that the whole story? Or is there another element also involved in it? Not only an external aspect, which is the, as we commonly say, the seeing of the object or person, but an internal aspect. There is a feeling associated with it, isn't there? And this feeling is rooted in the actual sensation that was produced by the functioning of the sense of sight. If light rays come from some external object, enter the retina, and you know the rest of the story, there is a sensation, isn't there? A sensation. And that sensation is indispensable for the perceiving to take place. Now the brain does not seem to take any further account of the sensation as such, apart from just taking the sensation in its stride as a matter of course. We tend to confine our knowing to that which is external, that which builds up the concept in association with the word which is used to describe this external aspect of the perceiving. Mother, or mum, we'll say, and dad, dolly, or doggy, or whatever it is. This feeling aspect seems to go on rather unconsciously, subconsciously. It's below the surface, it's the hidden part of it. A feeling content which is intimately bound up with the actual sensation, which is the physical phenomenon, the electrochemical processes that take place, and touch the brain. So now, when we are grown up, we have a whole set of concepts. If I look at a flower or a star, does my concept, which immediately tells me, oh, that's a flower, that's a star, does that concept constitute, or rather, that concept at work, giving a name to my seeing the flower or the star, does that constitute the whole of my knowing? Or is there inwardly a feeling content also at work all the time? And can I really know, although I may see, and the concept may give a name, that is that, do I really know what I am seeing? Do I really know the flower in that feeling sense, the awareness of its sensation? And the sensation remains unnamed, doesn't it? The pure sensation, that is to say, the purely physical part, the light rays and the electrical disturbances and all the rest of it, you see? It remains unnamed. We have discovered the mechanics of the act of seeing only in this century itself. We've never known it before. That is to say, as far as one can say. So now, this process of knowing implies the two aspects. This external aspect, which is so external to us, tied up with the use of the word, the name, which is only a sound acting as a label. And the word concept is applied mainly to this part of the process of knowing. But this inner part, this feeling content, is not an analyzed thing. What is the structure of this feeling content? Has it a structure? Or is it a somewhat vague sort of mass? Something which may perhaps be quite a universalized thing. I don't know. But it is something most worthwhile attempting to penetrate. You know the that sentence in Genesis, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. Now note carefully, Adam did not conceive, she conceived. This outgoing, external male is not the real conceiver. He is indispensable, of course, for the process. But it is this intaking, indrawn, not withdrawn, but inward going, feminine, female, who conceives when Adam knew his wife. You get it? Within ourselves, then, this dual process goes on. This, not so much dual as this and the other, but this double process, simultaneously. The feeling aspect, with regard to the sensation produced inside, plus the external aspect, which recognizes that which sent out the stimuli which reached the brain. And between the two of them, those two aspects in their complete togetherness constitute the full knowing, which is the real meaning of conceiving. Now you see what I'm driving at. Our concepts as such are merely the label on the goods. Like saying, parcel of sweets or books or whatever it is. The goods are the sweets and the books, but the label tells you at once what they are, and of course, because of our experience, we know that inside this package are sweets or books, as the case may be. So this external part, which is so intimately associated with the word, is just the analytical part of the story. And as such, it is the conditioner. The concept is the conditioner. It is the binder. The feeling part has an unconditioned aspect to it. The feeling part is not named. I'm talking of feeling not in terms of an emotional or any other reaction, remember, or response. Not that. But feeling more akin the psychical feeling which is more akin to the sense of touch rather than the sense of sight. If we can follow this, if we can explore this together carefully, you will see what we are getting at. Now remember that the concept, when formed, is something fixed. When the sense of sight operates, the sensation created by the activity of the of the eyes and so forth, and the fact that one is, of course, paying attention, one is being conscious of what is happening, the concept tends to suppress the feeling aspect when it gives the name. And the concept says, oh, that's that. And the moment the name is given and an identification is made of the separate object or person, the perceiving in its wholeness becomes suppressed or even quite dismissed. You see how the intellect appears to tell us the fact, and it does, up to a certain extent, it appears to tell us the fact, but it prevents us from experiencing the fact. That is to say, because it inhibits the feeling activity, the live communication between that which is conveyed to me by my sense of sight and myself as a whole person, the communication is really suppressed. There is no communion then. Say,
patient endurance.
Say, two of us are walking together, or 20 of us are walking together in the country. It's a little more convenient to say two of us. Two of us are walking together in the country. We are conversing with each other. We pass by some beautiful flowers. Or a haystack, or a heap of manure or something. An impress, of course, is formed by the sight or the smell, or maybe sight and smell. An impress on the brain is made. It is sent out to us from what we see or smell, but there is an insufficient feeling response, especially in the case of the activity of the sense of sight purely. The sense of smell, that's why I specifically mentioned the heap of manure, may operate so powerfully that it calls forth a reaction, a powerful reaction. Now, if when we are walking together and conversing, our aesthetic sense is sufficiently powerfully awake at the same time, then the feeling aspect would complete our seeing the flower or the haystack or whatever it was. Otherwise, the concept working in the mind, in the hinterland more or less, says, oh, roses, or dandelions, or buttercups, or daisies, or whatever it is. And in saying that, you just dismiss it out of consciousness. In other words, we are prevented from being wholly aware all the time to everything that comes within our purview through the operation of the senses. I specifically say through the operation of the senses, because what is at the back of my head will not come into my purview, and therefore I cannot be in communion with it. Now, have you been able to follow that clearly? Now, another factor enters into the situation. Our stored up memories of past reactions and responses to the functioning of our senses. Again, say, I am walking along. I see something which has been a source of pleasure to me. And I react to it by an outgoing feeling towards that which gave me pleasure. Maybe, say, a concert hall, we'll say, or somebody who is very dear to me. So there's the immediate pleasure and the outgoing like that. Or if it is somebody whom I dislike, then there is another sort of reaction. But either reaction, the one of attachment, the other of aversion, through the action of the memory of the past, prevents a full communion. Because the communication that takes place on seeing the loved one or the disliked one is hindered. The communication is hindered by the emotional reaction. This gives us a completely different vision of the nature of real love. In real love, the loved or the liked or the disliked object or person has no place. That is to say, the liking and the disliking have no place. One is aware, one is paying attention completely cleanly. The slate is always wiped clean of what memory has written down upon it. It is in that empty state. This is one of the deep meanings of the shunya. In that empty state, there is the possibility of the full communion. That empty state is the pure state. And in that communion is the perfect knowing. The knowing which perhaps is suggested in, and Adam knew his wife Eve, And she conceived. She brought forth Cain, who is misrepresented as the murderer of Abel. Those who go deeply enough into the Kabbalah will see into it. Cain is the Lord incarnate. Remember Eve's words, "I have gotten a man of the Lord," not of Adam. She doesn't say Adam. So you see, that means that where there is the true process of conceiving as the result of the full and proper activity of the external and internal aspects of the living process through the sense functioning, there is transcendence everlastingly present. You remember the other day I said, whatsoever comes to us through the senses, if we are really attentive and fully awake to it, they are all the signs of transcendence. In transcendence we live and move and have our being. In the most literal sense, except insofar as we ourselves remain unawakened. Now, I've used sort of physical conditions. I've talked about things and persons. And we have seen the difficulties involved with concrete objects and how we are conditioned, limited, and thus full knowing, full conceiving does not take place. Now, when we come to the abstract realm of qualities, things like virtues, we are in still greater difficulty. Because the concrete object makes its impress far more easily through our senses. But when we say harmlessness, truthfulness, where are we? What is truth? Said Pilate, and waited not for the answer. Harmlessness, truthfulness, kindliness, all these things are words, they are sounds. But what is the living content involved in those sounds? Those sounds are labels for a living content, for a meaning which is not merely another word or a string of words to explain this word, but a meaning which is the living, throbbing reality, a power and energy which actually affects us and with which we actually can affect the environment in which we live. You see, here we really go into very deep waters, we are plunging into an unknown ocean. Now you see, these words have obtained their dictionary meanings through the naming process of our experience. I am a little child. I am playing with my friend, another little child. The other little child, let us say, falls down, and I laugh. It seems to be a natural reaction for one child to laugh at discomfiture of another, or its pain or something. The first reaction is laughter. Child sees grandma tumbling down the stairs and thinks it's wonderfully hilarious. Then mama comes along and says, "No, no, Jim, now we must be kind to that little fellow. Be kind. Now help him on, pick him up." And the tone, the gesture, the activity that goes on, perhaps it's bruised its knee and a little bit of something is brought along into and is that better and this and that. You see, now all these impressions raise up are the experiencing by that child of kindness, friendliness, whatever it is. And so these words begin to, as we say, mean something for me, the little child. And before long, the concept gets formed. And then when similar situations occur, immediately there comes up in my mind, "Oh, I ought to be kind," or I ought to take care," or whatever it is. The ought to and the limited concept is in play. But whilst it will produce what we commonly regard as desirable social results, do I grow, truly grow, in the reality which is kindness, which is compassion, which is truthfulness, etc.? You see, the word and the concept which it represents have interfered with the internal activity. This whole feeling activity, which sort of embraces the totality like space does. My loving kindness is not a spacious loving kindness. Consider in this connection what the Buddha taught about the Brahma Viharas, the divine residences. Let the mind be pervade one quarter of the mind. This is only a way of talking, one quarter. You can't cut up the mind into four nice quarters, like a plum pudding or something. Pervade one quarter of the mind with loving kindness, immeasurable, without end. And pervade everything around with that loving kindness. See, there is this element of immeasurability attached to the feeling aspect of the thing. Perhaps this was his way of suggesting how one frees oneself from the imprisoned state due to the limitations imposed upon the mind by the concept, the word. Supposing a person is perishing with thirst, it's no good him merely thinking water, or somebody saying water to him. You want the stuff which is water. It is the same with all these qualities, these virtues. What is the stuff which is truth? This psychical, this spiritual, this intangible, immeasurable, living, real energy, which is truth, which is love, or kindness, or anything you like, or humor, or honesty, or faith. What is this real living stuff? You remember some years back at one of our group meetings, we were talking about faith, and I suggested a little equation. Faith full equals belief empty. What is the real living stuff of it? This is what we want to get hold of. It's a funny way of saying get hold of. However, you know what I mean. This is what we want to understand. Because when we really understand this, it operates freely. It comes into action. Otherwise, that energy, that psycho-spiritual energy, is all dammed up. We have to let loose the flood waters of compassion or whatever it is. So now, you remember yesterday then, in the afternoon, we tried to round off our considerations with meditating upon a particular virtue. Now, in this meditation process, the feeling of the quality which we took up must be allowed to well out. This, of course, is an opening up of the reservoirs of profound mental energies, mind energies within us. Then the meditation becomes a true power for transmutation, not only transformation. See, people say, often ask, how do I meditate? And I have sometimes said, why don't you ask me, how do I chew? You can chew naturally, can't you? Well, try and meditate naturally. Let the meditation process take place by itself, naturally. Of course, some of you will probably be having a great big question mark over your head straight away. How do I let the feeling aspect open up when the concept is preventing me? Well, just try. See what happens. It is a case of trying without effort. Because the effort has to be directed by a preconceived idea of it, which is again another concept, a limiting concept, always. You know, in life, where there is the reality of love, you don't have to try to be loving. It just flows out. You can't stop it. It is the mystery. And it is the same with all the qualities, the virtues. It is because love, in its concrete aspect of sex, and the being in communion with the external world, in its concrete aspect of eating food. Food comes from the outside, whether it be vegetables, meat, fruit, whatever it is. They are substances from the outside, which we chew and take into ourselves and digest. We become completely at one, don't we, in eating the food. The food and I become completely one in the act of eating. Those are the two elements, sex and food, which are the concretest expressions of love, of factual communion. So, where they are concerned, we have no difficulty. But where these other things are concerned, the subtler things, the distinguishing characteristics of true humanness, truthfulness, harmlessness, and all the rest of it, non-covetousness, and so forth. It is rather more difficult, because there's hardly anything in our actual, concrete, physical life which has an expression of these things in itself. You will get concrete physical expression of certain things at least as our awareness of our daily life frees itself from bondage to the three elements that compose our daily living. Sex, food, business. Then, to use the Kundalini Yoga symbolism, as you ascend upwards, there emerges this activity which is our humanity in constant expression. The social sense in its full development, represented at anahata. Speech as a true communicator, which is prophetic speech, represented by Vishuddhi. And knowing in the full sense in which I have so feebly tried to convey to you, represented by Ajna. And then the ultimate, the Sahasrara. The total communion stage, in which every limitation upon us of the concept or of the named feeling is out. Then there is the totality of being, the fullness of being. Only rarely do we go through that complete fullness of being. We never know it when it is happening. We never know it. We may afterwards be fortunate enough to retrospectively to suddenly awake to the fact that was it. So now, in any meditation practice with regard to the virtues as such, or whatever your subject of meditation may be, try and be awake to both aspects. The external perceiving aspect, which will merely be a string of words through the mind, and they are all limited and limiting. They all belong to the realm of the finite and the mortal. Try and disentangle yourself from that, as well as the named feeling, if a cognizable feeling rises up. I am talking of this generalized feeling, which has no name to it, but which has this sort of universal quality to it, like space is universal, immeasurable. And you will find then that what the teachers have said with regard to meditation, that benediction comes upon you. The realization of the immeasurable has taken place. You don't realize it. The immeasurable finds no obstruction in you and through you. And that is the blessed condition, the condition of supreme felicity, the nirvana, the ananda, the bliss, or if you like to call it, use it, the peace that passes all understanding. Now, in the process of learning to use our senses fully, what we cognize through the release and the development of the feeling aspect will reveal something which is quite different from the purely external and subsequently verbalized activity of the senses. Take as an example, say a tree. And its flowers or fruit or whatever it is. When we look at it, we immediately name it, if we happen to know the name. And if we are interested in trees and flowers especially, we know such a lot about the properties, the place where such trees are to be found and what happens and all the rest of it. We know it in the academic way. If our aesthetic sense responds to the actual seeing of the tree and the flowers, if a considerable amount of the feeling element is also at play, this adds to our delight, our joy at seeing this tree. And as we have tried to see earlier, we believe that we know this tree or flower. But also, as we have tried to see earlier, it is this analytical aspect, this conceptual aspect, which hinders the realizing of communion with the tree. When the feeling aspect comes more and more into play, to be differentiated, and this feeling aspect must be differentiated from the aesthetic experience, which we can always name as joy, delight, or appreciation, and so forth, this feeling aspect cannot be named. It is an indescribable aspect. And this feeling aspect, by actual touching, psychical touching, not physical touching, the psychical touching of what the sense of sight is conveying to us, gives us a different kind of knowing. But this different kind of knowing is by no means unrelated to the external, conceptual, verbalized knowing. The external conceptual verbalized knowing we all know about because it constitutes the ordinary course of our lives all over the world. But this inward knowing by feeling has its own specific nature, different from this intellectual verbalized knowing. And it is this which brings about the state of communion, which can bring about the state of communion. There is something else too, and this is very important. As this feeling aspect becomes more and more alive and active in us, it it changes our awareness of the inner nature of the tree and its flower and fruit. The conceptualized, verbalized knowledge is external. It is descriptive. It defines the object. It is perfectly true that the object as an object is a definite thing. It's a defined thing. It has its limitations in space. But this feeling aspect, when it operates more and more intensely, goes beyond that which the intellectual conceptualized knowing presents to us. So if you look at a tree as a tree, first you will know, to start with, you will know it is a tree and not a stone or a horse or a mosquito. You see? Immediately it is differentiated. But as the feeling aspect becomes more and more intense, a change takes place in your mode of awareness itself. It's your awareness of that tree as a differentiated particular gives place to an awareness which is quite, at least I can't give any description of it whatsoever. I can only say that it happens. It is this sort of thing which is implied in the saying that what you think upon, what you observe, you become. That is to say, you become it in awareness. And you can become it in awareness only insofar as the concept, the verbalized form of it, has ceased to interfere. As far as I know, this is something of the actuality of the experiencing, the objective fact of what happens in the experiencing of complete communion. Whatsoever stands between that and me is out. And therefore it's no longer that and me, but only the whole reality. This is the supremely harmless state. The fundamental meaning and reality of harmlessness. So you see, what is brought about by this kind of full, deep meditation? This is meditation in its reality. I'm finding it so difficult to try and put it across. Now, let us look at some of the descriptions given, especially, for instance, by Buddha Ghosha in his Path of Purification, that enormous treatise, the Visuddhimagga, regarding what are called the kasina meditations. Now, the kasinas are enumerated as the earth kasina, the water kasina. Kasina is just a symbol which you use. You can use a solid object as the earth kasina, a bowl of water as the water kasina, as the air in the room as the air kasina, as a flame for the fire kasina, and so forth, you see. Now, when one meditates on the earth kasina as such, one just has, say, a pot, an earthenware pot, we'll say. You see, there is the pot. Now, when you first look at it, you look at it very carefully, take in all the details, which of course is an analytical, synthetic process. The two together have to be there. Because you see every part which constitutes the whole of that pot very, very carefully. And you also note exactly its place in the pot, in other words, its relationship to the whole pot, its different color and whatever characteristics it may display. So it's an analytic, synthetic process. Then the mind knows, the brain knows that this pot is made out of earth. Right, an earthenware pot. You bear it very, very carefully in mind. And then you close your eyes and you get the after image. You see the pot clearly in your mind's eye. And you open your eyes again and look and see whether the picture which appeared in the mind is the exact counterpart in full of what has been conveyed through the eyes. See, this is a marvelous development of the power of paying attention. That is why it forms quite an important practice in samadhi, in meditation. You see, these are preliminary kindergarten exercises, but they are very difficult. You open your eyes and you see. Then you close your eyes again. And then once again the image appears, and so forth. You repeat this process until you develop the ability to take in the details so completely that the image in the mind is the exact replica, exact counterpart of that which you have seen with your eyes. Now you can hold your attention steady upon the picture in your mind. Now this is pure external, the external aspect of the sense function and the capacity for making that external aspect as perfect in technique as possible. When you close your eyes, the image is there and you just pay attention to that image alone. Now, having developed this power of attention, we come to the other aspect of it. You just are aware, deeply aware, that this is made of earth, earth, earth. The pot disappears, only earth is there in your consciousness, not the pot. Now, if you were to refer to the Chandogya Upanishad, when Uddalaka Aruni is instructing his son Shvetaketu, Aruni was the one who made that famous pronouncement to his son, Tat Tvam Asi, that thou art, stems from him, you see, in the Chandogya Upanishad. Now, when he is talking, he says, this is in another context, not in the context where he expounds that thou art, but in another context. He says, just as Everything made of gold is known by gold. You see? So too, and he goes on expounding. In other words, you get to the fundamental basic situation. Every gold object is known by knowing gold. Now that is how it is written in the Sanskrit and translated quite rightly as gold. But I would like to put it this way. Everything that is made of gold is known by knowing goldness. Now, this goldness, what is the ness? This is the indescribable aspect of it. But you will feel it. And if you find yourself being able to describe, to verbally describe that feeling, then rest assured you're on the wrong track. This is the whirling activity of the bright mind, of the bright intellect. It's practically, in fact, it is impossible to describe, because description means definition, and it doesn't apply to this ness. Why? Because this which is the ness, N-E-S-S, ness of things, is universal reality. The universal, the infinite, can never be described, defined in finite terms. It can only be perhaps suggested. A vibration can be aroused in the psyche by some suggestive word. That is all one can do. See? All right. You will become aware of this ness. Or shall I say, you'll become aware in terms of the ness. A practical man may say, well, so what? All right, supposing you do these marvelous things, what use are they in the practical world? They have no use in the practical world in terms of the standards and criteria and the driving forces for action in the practical world. You're not going to gain anything. You're not going to make bigger profits. You're not going to have greater social security or comfort or anything like that. Not at all. The use is just here, that the profounder depths of the mind awaken, come to life, and are operative in you in your everyday life. That is to say, you begin to live more and less and less as the worldly man, with all the conflicts of the duels and the evil and trouble and misery attached to worldly life. You'll live less and less in accordance with that, and more in that state of equanimity, that harmony, that poise, which the Buddha named Upekkha, in this world itself. That is where the difference comes. See? So you come to recognize the ness of things. You know the goldness of gold. Now, coming back to the earth kasina, you know, and I'm saying no now, in that sense, Adam knew his wife. The external and the internal, the feeling aspect and the external aspect, are all in a real unity, operating in a real unity. Coming to know this, then you know what earthiness means, what earthness is. Why should we know what earthness is? our own physical constitution is made up of solids, liquids, gases, and so forth. And you will find in the texts, both the Hindu, you'll find it in the Upanishads, several of them, I've got them with me here. You'll find it in the Upanishads, you'll find it in the Buddhist writings. You see, this body, bones, teeth, and so forth, are the earthy part of it. They correspond to earth. Once one is aware of earthness in this total sense, any sort of conflict of liking and acceptance or disliking and rejection with regard to our own earthness is out. You see, it's a liberation. Supposing this body of mine has some disgustingly ugly, bony protuberance somewhere. Now, if I am the ordinary vain man of the world, I will go to some surgeon or somebody and try and extirpate it. If it is actually harmful to the life of the body, well, that's common sense. That's a different matter. But if it is not harmful, if it is just naturally there, all right, let be. Why should I not let dear old bony protuberance be dear old bony protuberance? Why should I deny it living space, Lebensraum? You see, that state of conflict, that constant itch in the psyche, the discomfort in the psyche because of the perpetual dislike, every time I look in the mirror or can see it directly, I'm upset and all that is out. One is at peace. This is what comes of being aware of the earthness and acceptance because of liking and rejection because of disliking are finished with.
To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind.
Yes. That's exactly what it is. Now, similarly with the water kasina. You come to grow in awareness of the wateriness of liquids or the liquidity of any watery substance or anything like that. And again, the same sort of result can follow. And same with air and fire, and then there is color, then there is the kasina of space itself. Now, it's very funny. You may say, how do I make a kasina of space? You can't catch hold of a bit of space. So what they do is they are in a room which is completely enclosed, a wooden one, because it is of course, nowadays you can drill a hole through a solid wall even. All right. You drill a hole through the wall. And that hole is your kasina of space. The same with light. There again you have your hole and it lets in the sunlight. Or the moonlight, as the case may be. And you use that as the kasina. And you come to be aware in the liberated manner, in the liberated mode, of all the elements that compose our whole being. This is the point about it. It is by no means knowledge in our ordinary academic sense of the word knowledge. The analytical description of shape, form, color, properties, characteristics, chemical reactions, this, that and the other, utilities and so forth, all that is not in it. This is a different thing. And life operates through its container. And its container is the elements, as we used to call them in the past. Nowadays, your chemical elements are somewhat different from that. But you see, this is what that meditation process does. Now, if I remember right, I must make that proviso because I went through my Vishuddhimagga 1960 and 61, and I haven't looked at it since. This feeling part of it has not been touched upon, if I remember right. But this feeling part, this feeling aspect is very important. Mind you can't conjure up the feeling. You can't command it to operate. You can only be quiet and allow it to operate. You won't know whether it is operating properly or improperly. I don't think there is anything like an improper operation of that feeling, apart from the fact that if a string of words starts coming up in your mind, then the feeling part has once again been thrown down into the cellar. See, apart from that, the feeling part will operate. This inner sensitivity of the mind. And you see the importance of this inner sensitivity of the mind, this feeling part, coming to life. Practically all of you, I think, at our group meetings have heard me talk about one of the difficulties with respect to mindfulness. We practice mindfulness, as we say, for 10 days, 10 months, 10 years, 10 ages, and say, at the end of it all, I'm no forwarder. And I've tried to explain how that mindfulness has been confined to this externalized mindfulness. Seeing what you are seeing by holding the thing at a distance. I'm overwhelmed with anger. Anger is manifest here. Then I project it outside and say, I am looking at my anger down there. That's no use. That's cold, it's not no use, but it is only one small aspect of mindfulness. When I see the anger and recognize that this is anger, not kindliness, that's the verbal, intellectual part of it, then my inner sensitivity must go out to it. Or, put it the other way around, take it right inside my being and really let the feeling side of me fully touch it, fully absorb it, fully absorb it. See? Then I really know what anger is. If you can practice this successfully, you'll find yourself quite rapidly getting free of the reaction of anger, the rising up of one's gorge at what happens. Whatever happens, we may see a terrible injustice done. We may see the leaders of the country, the politicians and so on, taking us post haste to ruin and what not, you see. Or we may see what we call cruelty being exercised over children, over animals, or beautiful things being ill-treated, and so forth and so forth. And our anger rises up, associated with the feeling of pity and compassion. But the feeling of pity and compassion becomes so emotional that it is a disturbed state. And in that disturbed state, one can't respond in a manner which is pure compassion and pure healing. If one is free from the emotional mix-up with the compassion, then there is the best chance of letting the right thing come about. One does act, of course, one does act. But the action which at the back of it has this emotional upset associated with it is never so effective in its practical results as the action of the one in poise. And when this feeling aspect has really come to life, it is a calm thing. It is a poised thing. It is a really knowing thing. You know, we always say, the knowing one can do the right thing here and put it right. And one looks for the knowing one. So one goes to so-and-so, who is an expert on these matters. He is the knowing one. He is the old man of the village, the Buddha, the enlightened one, the Buddha. Buddha is just the ordinary form, the nominative case is Buddha, the old one. So you see, what extraordinary things emerge out of this simple thing. Simple. This difficult simple thing, shall I say. But as far as I'm aware, this lies at the heart of the practice, the fruitful practice of meditation, and not the mere sitting down and going through a verbal ritual or whatever it may be. Otherwise, it's mumbo-jumbo, which is no different from the professional ritualist who just patters away the set prayers or whatever the procedure may be. It becomes a thing of power in action and in right action. So now, when you meditate upon the yamas, let that feeling aspect emerge, and you will find that the substantial reality of harmlessness, truthfulness, continence, kindliness, steadiness of mind in pain and pleasure and success and failure and all the rest of it, all those things will become a living reality. Not just a collection of verbal fossils in the mind. Now we'll bear this in mind for the afternoon today, shall we? And we'll try it, we'll practice it. Because when this is successfully and fully carried out, you really enter into the jhanas. the real deep states of consciousness. One of the great things I learnt from Buddha Ghosha's Vishuddhimagga.